I'm Bill Middleton, the general chairman of ICC 76. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome all of you to this, the 12th annual IEEE International Communications Conference. May you all enjoy the conference, partake to the fullest of the technical and social programs which have been arranged. We sincerely hope that our planning has been responsive to your desires. And when you leave on Wednesday, you will find every reason to feel that this has been a worthwhile visit to Philadelphia during this bicentennial year. And now, without any further comment, and in deference to our very tight program, let us proceed with the luncheon. I believe that all of you have been served dessert by this time, and I believe that we can go ahead with the program while you finish your dessert. I neglected to call attention to my prior remarks to the fact that we have welcoming signs to our international visitors in many languages on the wall to the rear of this meeting room. We're very happy to have the many international guests with us that are here for this conference. I'm also told that the bird flew well this morning, which I hope is portends a successful conference. At the head table today, in addition to our distinguished speaker and other honored guests, we have two officers of the IEEE Communications Society who have been most intimately associated with these conferences, and also the Executive Committee of ICC 76. I would like to recognize these folks at the head table at this moment. On your left, Carol Williams, Chairman of the Philadelphia Section of IEEE and the Secretary of this conference. Next to him, Dr. Ralph W. Windrum, the Technical Program Chairman. Next, Thomas G. Dalby, the incoming chairman and present secretary and vice chairman of the Communications Society Conferences Board. Next is the Honorable Louis J. Carter, chairman of the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission. And to you, Commissioner Carter, this conference is honored by your presence. With your very busy schedule, we hope that you will find the environment of this conference very beneficial to your great responsibilities as the chairman of one of the most prestigious regulatory bodies in the United States. Next is our honored speaker for this keynote luncheon, about whom you will hear more later, the Honorable Benjamin L. Hooks. My left, Walter E. Noller, president of the IEEE Communications Society. Next, Stanley Zebrowitz, familiar to many of you as chairman of the conference's board and soon to be director of meetings and conferences for the Communications Society. Stan is also the advisor to ICC 76. Next is Charlie Horn, executive vice chairman of ICC 76 and my right-hand man in making this conference a very successful operation. I want to acknowledge the dedicated effort that Charlie has put into this project, also along with his wife, Pat, who has served capably as the chairwoman of the social activities. Next is Al Mack, vice chairman for technical affairs, who has coordinated the various pieces of the technical side of this conference. Next is Dick Schaphorst, vice chairman for administrative affairs, who's done a yeoman job in organizing and steering the many less glamorous aspects of local arrangements, special events, registration, and others. Bob Mayer, the treasurer and financial chairman for ICC 76, an experienced and valuable asset to any conference committee. In addition to the executive committee, there are many hard workers serving as committee chairman or as committee members. And at this time, I would like all of the ICC 76 committee people to rise while we recognize their work with a round of applause. As many of you know, a conference of this size and scope could not happen without the solid support of the communications industry, who give us backing in the form of exhibits, patron support, and perhaps that which is appreciated by the hardworking members of the committee and the Institute, making available the time and other administrative support to the individuals in planning and implementing a conference such as this. We thank you, we salute you for your awareness and for your faith in the profession that these meetings help to grow in stature and expertise. At this time, I would also like to recognize another honored guest, Commissioner Michael Johnson, a member of the Public Utility Commission in Pennsylvania. Commissioner Johnson, will you stand, sir? At this time, I would like to call on Stanley Zebrowitz for a few brief comments. Stan.
As Bill mentioned, this is the 12th ICC, and they have been getting better. The quality has been improving constantly, if that's at all possible. And as I was walking across the street here with Ralph Wyndham, not waiting to wait for the double-decker bus, which everybody should try, incidentally, he told me that he was getting the preliminary results from the first session, the ratings of the first session, and was getting some very, very fine compliments on the quality of the technical program. So I'm sure we're going to have an extremely successful conference in all respects. Starting in 1972, the Communication Society reorganized its conference activities and established the Communication Society Conference Board. And the conference board has given this conference, the International Communication Conference, and the National Telecommunication Conference, which meets in the winter, in November, the end of November, the beginning of December, and many of you have been to the National Telecommunication Conferences, continuity and leadership. And at this point in time, I'd very much like to call upon two former officers of the Communication Society Conference Board and give them a very small token of our esteem and thanks for their extremely dedicated services in helping to make this series of conferences the outstanding success that they have been. First, I'd like to call on Dick Shuey, who is currently the Vice President of Technical Affairs for the Communication Society, and who was the first chairman of the Communication Society Conference Board. Dick?
Congratulations.
Thank you, Stanley.
Oh, did you want to take one? We can get it back. All right. And secondly, I'd like to call upon Charlie Horn, who is one of the past officers of the Communication Society Board and who has served in an extremely dedicated and outstanding fashion for all of the activities of the Society. Charlie? Thank you.
Thank you, Stan. At this time, I'd like to call on Walt Noller, president of the IEEE Communication Society, who will now make several recognitions on behalf of the Society.
Thank you, Bill. Again, we as an organization, which is run by a number of volunteers, must continuously change this volunteer help in order to keep the Society in its ever-growing mode. I would like to take just a few moments to recognize a few of those who have left their great services behind to make us what we are today. First of all was Al Culbertson, who was our first president and until this year was chairman of the Advisory Council. Also, then comes Fred Hurd, who left us as a member of our Board of Governors. Also, Bill Utla, who served as on our Board of Governors. And then we had Don Atkinson, who was General Chairman of the 1971 ICC in Montreal, and then later served on our Board of Governors, also as Vice President of International Affairs. And we have one new member, retiring, namely Steve Weinstein, who has done such a fantastic job of editing our Communication Society magazine. I'd like to give a round of applause to these people to denote our appreciation of their activities. Also, they will receive a very nice certificate of recognition from the Communication Society.
Thank you, Walt. If a conference chairman can take pride in the technical program, I feel very grateful to Ralph Windrum, Al Mack, and the others for the job that they have done for this technical bill of fare for the Bicentennial Conference. As you know, some of the thrust of this particular conference has to do with the social impact of communications, and we have been trying to make sure that the conference is fully aware of all of the aspects that technology and the social aspects come together in this ever-increasing and complex world of ours. In searching our minds for an individual to set the stage by addressing the group for this keynote luncheon, there was one name that came to mind immediately for his intellectual pursuit of fact and broad-ranging evaluative concern about the impact of communications today and tomorrow. And I'm not going to introduce the speaker today like I heard of one a short time ago where the Toastmaster said, I'm going to introduce Mr. So-and-so who has 20 minutes in which to make a speech before he has to catch a plane. I think you'll find our speaker today will give you a real message. Benjamin L. Hooks became known to a larger group of the United States citizens when he was appointed to the Federal Communications Commission in 1972. It has been evident since his appointment that the commission has been the beneficial recipient of a member truly dedicated to the highest levels of integrity in carrying out his own discernment of the responsibilities of a public servant. A background sketch of Commissioner Hooks has been included in the luncheon program. I'm sure that you will find it to the picture of a very versatile individual who has found it possible to manage several careers while achieving preeminence in law, theology, and business. All the while, he has been a strong spokesman for his race in the area of human relations. The fact that Commissioner Hooks has indulged in the field of television as a producer and host of his own show no doubt makes him unique, both as to his wide background, but also for a member of the FCC. You are all anxious to hear this very talented public servant who I am told is often referred to as Judge Hooks from his service on the bench, and I would not like to delay this experience further. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Commissioner Benjamin L. Hooks, Federal Communications Commission, who will speak on competition in the common carrier industry. Commissioner Hooks.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Middleton, for that very generous introduction. He has already asked my permission, which I have graciously given because I had no other way to get around it, that he could tape what I had to say today. And the reason I want to tape is because I'm not speaking from notes, although I did bring a good speech that will be included, I'm sure, in the minutes of this occasion that will reflect the wisdom and integrity and sobriety with which we approach regulatory problems in Washington. So it'll be included. I tell you, it's mind-boggling to read through these things. And Commissioner Carter and I have just been getting some help. I did see the advantage of television to Eskimos in Alaska, and that's one of the papers I plan to send for, because I'm sure that I'll be able to use that some way as I talk about deprivation of black folk in the inner city. I'll be able to find something. So we're always finding some ways to go. I, I noticed not an all-white audience. There may be some black folk here, but I haven't seen them. But don't worry about it. I'm not going to unloose on you because of that. I'll be back again. You know, in the early days of integration, when we were unsure of ourselves, and white speaker came to black audience, and the black man who was introducing was not quite sure how to get it together. And he's been talking about Black Friday and black cats, you know, and black sheep of the family, and all the connotations of blackness being bad. But he wanted to give this white gentleman a good introduction because he knew him and believed in him. He said, now, when he got down to the close of the introduction, he said, now, brothers and sisters, it is true he is a white man. He has a white skin, but I don't want you to be afraid of him because beneath that white skin, his heart is just as black as mine. Whatever that means. But being with the FCC and some of you involved with us, Dick Wilder has a story. I don't know whether you've heard it, but it doesn't make any difference whether you have or not, because I'm going to tell it anyway. But he says there are three great lies known to people and in ascending order. One is when you tell somebody, of course, I put the check in the mail this morning. Haven't you got it yet? And the second is, in another type of setting, you know, yes, that I've asked my wife for a divorce. You know that. And perhaps the greatest lie. Hello, my name is Ben Hooks. I'm from the FCC, and I'm here to help you. And then we have another commissioner who tells this during the FCC. He goes around and he points out, primarily to broadcasters and AT&T, that he thinks the time has come to stop complaining about the FCC because, after all, we're not very difficult to get along with if you just remember one or two things. And the main thing to remember is that getting along with the FCC is like making love to a gorilla. It can be done, but it must be done on the gorilla's terms. So if all of you have to deal with us, if you just remember those words of wisdom and come up prepared. But just for a few moments today, I want to talk about maybe a little. I may touch on competition, which you know more about than I do. But I want you to think in terms of regulation of the public interest, and maybe. As I have made this speech in many places in the country, I found that so many people are not really aware of what the FCC is all about in its totality. I went to a meeting not long ago of the Indiana-Illinois Telephone Association, I believe it was, down in French Lick, Indiana. And it was a very interesting meeting, and maybe 50 or 60 I think they call them independent telephone companies, are represented there. Some very colorful characters. I don't really understand what motivates them. One fellow was as proud and happy as anything I'd ever seen in my life. He had 700 subscribers. He worked 7 days a week, so he said 18 hours a day for 40 years. And this was only 3 years ago he had a chance to visit. And I said, well, you know, why do you stay in business? You know, and he said, well, it's the challenge of the thing, the challenge to grow. I said, okay, you know, he'll grow. In 40 years he has 700, I guess. Maybe another 40 he'll have 800. But I asked them the question, why was it that FCC commissioners are invited to go all over the country for broadcasters associations? In fact, you consider spoil sport if you don't go. And yet, in the time I had served, I don't recall a commission ever having visited such a group. And the answer they gave was that, well, because you don't regulate us, and we didn't feel that we ought to have you. And yet, nothing could be further from the truth, because I have been told, and this I believe, that because of the separations requirement and interstate revenue, that we do impact whatever regulations we make about long-distance rates have direct and very definite impact on all of the independent telephone companies in the country. And as we deal with specialized common carriage and terminal equipment manufacturers, we directly impact on all of the means of communication. So I the thought that maybe I would take just a few minutes today to talk about the FCC, and then to close, if I might, on this business of competition, the commentary. FCC was started in 1934, rather, as a result of the passage of an act of Congress called the Communications Act. And the Communications Act was actually the outgrowth, a result of the 1928 Act called the Federal Radio Act. But in 1934, it was decided that they would include the telephonic communications in the one commission. And since that time, these past 40-some years, we've had the job of trying to expedite speedy and rapid and use of wireless and telegraphy. And some years ago, the FCC was divided into bureaus so that they could more closely approximate the types of jobs that they should do. Prior to that time, there'd only been two sets of, they'd been divided into lawyers on the one hand and engineers on the other, and they crossed the board on all of the things that had to be done. But it became apparent somewhere in the 50s that this was sort of an unwieldy arrangement. And now we're divided into bureaus. Well, one bureau is the Cable Bureau, with about 100 people involved. I might say now set that the FCC has perhaps 2,000 and 2,100 people on board, and our budget is somewhere in the neighborhood now, $50 million. And the Cable Bureau is one of the operating bureaus, as we call it, with about 100 people now. When a cable started, as most of you know, because of the fact that television signals travel on line of sight, and those who lived in the hollows and the valleys and behind certain mountains were not able to get good signals, and cable started as a means to receive the signal on the dish and then retransmit it down where it was necessary. And for many years, the FCC resisted any overtures toward regulating cable. But finally, a decision was made that perhaps we would have to regulate cable, even though there's nothing in the Communications Act that specifically says that. And the basis of our jurisdiction, as explained in the case, was because of its impact on over-the-air broadcasting. And it was sustained by the Supreme Court in a very narrow decision, by the way, 5-4. And since that time, we've been up to our neck in problems with cable. We have to issue certificates of compliance to every cable system in the country. We are involved in leapfrogging rules and distant signal invitation and rules for pay cable and anti-siphoning. I know more about cable than I ever hope to know and I ever really need to know, even as a commissioner. But we spend an inordinate amount of our time on this field, in this field. And then we have what is known as the Broadcast Bureau. There's some 7,000 commercial radio stations in the country, more than 700 commercial television stations, some 800 or 900 so-called educational radio stations, and perhaps 250 educational television stations, all of whom must be relicensed every 3 years. And in the Broadcast Bureau, in our renewal branch, we attempt to ascertain whether or not a station has operated in the public interest, because as you very well know, the decision was made in the early days of radio that the spectrum belonged to the public and that those who used it were not to be considered owners, but were trustees or licensees. And once you say that you can use an instrumentality which you don't own, there have to be some standards established. And the standard established was that in a good legal phrase, which resounds down through the corridors of time with great clarity and ambiguity at the same time, that you must serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And like the ancient doctrine, Commissioner Carter, you know, the reasonable man, lawyers have gotten rich and great-great-grandchildren will be educated in the best schools of the land, no matter what inflation does to it, trying to interpret what is the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And out of this, it spawns such things as the Fairness Doctrine, congressionally passed legislation on equal time access, lowest unit cost, and the public involvement in the broadcasting field started off in 1966 primarily because of the United Church of Christ case that arose in Jackson, Mississippi. And since that time, we have hundreds of petitions that are now filed by private citizens. We have a Complaints and Compliance Bureau, and during this election year, we get on the average of 50 complaints every day. And while we are immune from political pressure, and none of us will ever yield. It is a fact that if a prominent senator who's engaged in a heated re-election campaign writes or calls for an interpretation, we do make an effort, believe it or not, to get the interpretation within the next 15 minutes and a half hour. So we're involved in that. Petitions to my new station applications, changes. I could stand here for an hour and tell you that the 250 to 275 people involved in the broadcast bureau actually produce a tremendous load of work. It's mind-boggling, really, to see what they have to do. And then we have the Safe and Special Bureau, and I'm sure you know about that. We are charged at the FCC with the duty of allocating the spectrum for all non-federal governmental uses. And perhaps some of you involved in the 900 megahertz proceedings, and you know about our experiment out of Chicago, where we've spent millions of dollars, and I'm not sure what we produced for the millions of dollars. I went out there one day, and they put me in a van and closed the door, and they had a bunch of little squiggly things running across computers, and they were running and ripping and racing, and they opened the door and said, "Commissioner, you see what we're doing?" Well, I was afraid they'd put me back in it, but I said, "No." I said, "Yes." "It's a great thing. It's a great thing." And the thing that is happening, and particularly was it brought into focus in the energy crisis, that petroleum companies and all other types of industrial companies and people who are in the business of delivering packages and the cab and the police and the fire department found that they could save millions and perhaps billions of dollars by having adequate radio communications. And you can understand that. I don't need to spend a great deal of time saying that at its very simple, the most simple level, if I had a package delivery company and I had a truck out there on the field with 20 packages and I received a call, "Don't drop that package at 1515 Stonewall because nobody would be there." If I could stop it with a radio, it would be better than burning the gas, using up the man's time, going there, knocking on the door, walking around to the back, and then going to the neighbor's house trying to ascertain why we can't leave the package. Multiply that by millions of such things, and you will find that we are caught in this squeeze as we try to decide how to allocate the spectrum. And millions of dollars involved in this. And of course, in the Safe and Special Bureau, as they explore for all, we've been called on to take some of the spectrum that was allocated to UHF television in certain cities and give it to the Safe and Special Bureau that they might use it in order to take care of those offshore oil rigs down in the Gulf and other coastal places in our country. And I need not mention CB radio, that new phenomenon which is sweeping America and catching on like wildfire. I think it took us 15 years to issue the first 1 million licenses in the Class D band, and we issued the second million in less than a year, and now we're issuing licenses at the rate of 20,000 a day. And if my calculation is correct, that means we'll issue a million every 10 weeks now. And it's just, you know, it's and then in addition to issuing the licenses, we have to police them and make sure that all of those people, do you know that during the Pennsylvania trucker strike, when the governor could not control the truckers here with the National Guard and the federal militia, that the FCC was called upon to go down and issue cease and desist orders to truckers and forbid them from using their CB radios in an illegal way? And except for us, you still have a trucker strike, but we can came down with our handy no pistols. At any rate, we have about 225 people involved in that, and I'll come back to that on one point in just a minute. And then we have the chief engineer's office with about 100 people, and basically they're involved in trying to make sure that all of the devices that are licensed to individuals in this country that are not accepted by Part 15 meet the test and requirements not only of our own regulations, but as you know, that we're involved in this whole national and international communications business, and we are involved in a lot of international conferences, and because we have these long borders with Canada on the one side and Mexico on the other, to the north and to the south, we have to be particularly careful. And with the emergence of third world countries and a new force is at work in these international conferences, and these countries are very jealous of international allocations that are made, and so we have to be respectful, even in our own country, of how we deal with international radio communications. And we're not always able to do that which might be best from a purely domestic viewpoint because of certain international policies which we must adhere to that have been entered into through the State Department, and we are powerless in many instances to change it except going through diplomatic channels and trying to do that, and that is sometimes a very difficult job. We have the Office of General Counsel, and in that context I might mention the Administrative Law Judges, the Review Board, all of the lawyers who are not assigned, director of the bureaus, and this may be 100 people. And then we have the Office of Plans and Policy. And I just glanced through. I don't promise to ever read all of that. I'm sure there's more in that, and I'll never be able to digest. But in looking through that, and looking through your program for the day, and I saw all the things you were dealing with, one of the things that struck me most forcibly was when I came to the FCC 4 short years ago, the Office of Plans and Policy had about 5 people. And here we are in the business of regulating, setting rules and standards, deciding what you can and cannot do. And yet in terms of long-range planning, in terms of trying to deal with the reality of now and the possibilities of tomorrow, the technological changes and breakthroughs that are changing rules in spite of our willingness to, our unwillingness to deal with it, that we are ill-equipped, almost non-equipped, to have the slightest concept of what we do today and how it will impact on what happens tomorrow. And our research budget, even now, is less than $700,000 for the whole totality of all of the things that we ought to be involved in. The commissioners have personal staffs of 5, which usually include 3 secretaries, and regardless of what you have heard, they do type, and they can't answer the phone. But I know that, I know you don't believe it, I know you'll leave here unconvinced, and but it happens. We have the field operations bureau with about 500 people. Now, that job, they're scattered in 30 stations all over the country. They inspect radios on ships, on little sailing craft, in airplanes. They inspect radio stations. They get complaints from the public about rates of the charge and things that are going wrong. They administer examinations for shortwave radio operators. They do a variety and multitude of things. And that's about 500 people. The executive director's office is sort of the housekeeping operations for the commission, the mail clerks, and we have to crank out paper. And we've got a lot of, we have the most modern machinery that's available for duplicating, mimeographing, and making facsimiles that you might be informed as to the great and erudite thinking that we're involved in. And so when we catch you, you'll be without an excuse because we've told you that if you just read what we put out, maybe a little difficult at times, but read it, and somewhere between page 1 and 100, you'll find what we're trying to say there. And lawyers do have to make a living, and we have to make our contribution to that. And I want to be frank, not only lawyers, but engineers. I don't want you just to laugh at lawyers, you know. I suspect there are more engineers here. And they helped write up some of those papers, too. They deliberately confused. I remember that joke they told about the fellow who went out to the cemetery, and he was wandering around looking at the tombstones, and he saw one, an inscription, "Here lies a lawyer and an honest man." And that was so perplexing to him, he kept looking. "Here lies a lawyer and an honest man." He thought, "Oh, my God. What a mistake they've made. They bury 2 folk in the same grave." So we're helping to make our contribution to all the things. So now, I think if my figures are correct, that if you follow me, that's up to about 2,100 people, except the common, and I did mention the Common Carrier Bureau, which is the bureau that perhaps most directly affects, I suppose, many or most of you here. And that bureau has about 250 or 275 people, and we're in the business of regulating the long-distance rates for American Telephone and Telegraph Company, and I think the last thing that I saw, something like $10 or $11 billion of that total revenue is realized through long-distance operations, and we are trying to deal with multi-point distribution systems. We're dealing with Western Union, and I had a strange experience the other day. Someone in the office down the hall from me had a relative to die, and I decided to send a telegram. You know, after all, I think I ought to use it since we regulate them and want to help them keep and stay in business. But when I got the bill, it was $10 and something. You know, I just couldn't believe it. So I did some checking and found that now to send a 15-word telegram to be hand-delivered costs $7.75. In the midst of all the modern technology, and I thought about Congressman Rinaldo, who said that, you know, what have you done for the common man? You've got Twix machines and Telex and all these other things for the big businessman, but you're closing down Western Union offices all over the country. And, of course, I voted against him. Someone told me it was wrong, so I just voted against it. I said, Congressman, I voted against that. And but in terms of the average consumer, and I'm not blaming Western Union. There have been many causes for all of these problems, but I'm simply trying to suggest that in the Common Carrier Bureau, Western Union, long-distance rates of AT&T, domestic and international satellites, multi-point distribution systems, mobile telephone systems, the rates to be charged by international common carriers. And we admittedly have not regulated international common carriers in the last 20 years. We just simply have not had the resources to do it. We're just abandoning the inquiry into the practices of the Western Union. And the reason for it is that we say, well, they don't make the rate of return that they're authorized to make, so why should we investigate them? The only reason we'd be concerned is if they're making too much, so there's no reason to investigate it. And you know, we have legislation before Congress now trying to change the amount of time in which we can suspend a tariff because we simply do not have the power. What's that word you told me? What was it? A people power. It used to be manpower, but it's employee power, whatever the new word is. I'm learning fast. But it's a person power. That's good. Thank you. To deal with the problem. Now, let me suggest the serious point that I'm trying to make. That it seems to me that when I went to Washington, like most people, I felt that the federal government was just an awesome bureaucracy of people, faceless individuals who were trying their best to make life unpleasant for most people with paperwork and all types of requirements. But in these 4 years, and maybe I'm a little bit prejudiced about it, that I've been with the FCC, I have become absolutely convinced that for the most part, 90% of the people in our bureau are hard-working, dedicated people, and the amount of work that we're called upon to do is simply mind-boggling, and never in the history of the FCC have we had enough people to really do the job right. Now, there are two major reasons for that. Most of the time, the industries that we regulate don't want the agencies to be large enough to do an effective job. And they thought if we keep them small, we'll keep them helpless and ineffective. And that hasn't been true at all. All you've done is just hamstring yourself, because the smaller we are, we still try to do as much as we can, but we do with inadequate resources, inadequate budget, inadequate opportunities to examine the things into the down to the correct detail. And there's an abiding passion in Congress to see to it. Even though we are deemed to be independent regulatory arms of Congress, it's very difficult to get any kind of appropriation from the Congress to do anything. So we, not only the FCC, but most of the old line regulatory agencies have been kept small and therefore ineffective. And one of the first things that I learned when I went on the FCC, when this whole business of specialized common carriers and the whole ball of wax that came out of the Carterphone decision dealing with terminal equipment came out of the desire partially of a common carrier bureau to have some yardstick by which to measure the monopolistic services of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. And one of the people, I won't call him the name, but that I had the conferences with when I first came to the commission and I was trying to understand the whole business of competition in the common carrier field, said that out of some frustration with the fact that year after year he had asked Congress for additional budget and additional people to deal with it. Because sometimes as I look at the amount of filings that come in, and I'm not being critical particularly of AT&T, and I'm certainly not being complimentary either, but they can file a whole room full of material. And we have one expert down there that I guarantee you if we send him to Russia, anything we want, we'd get it, because he gets through talking with you, he'll give up anything just to be rid of him. He stays down in a rather dank room on the inner corridor and reads all day long. And when he does get a chance to come up and express himself, it's judgment. You can't, you know, he just starts off. And he boggles all of the minds of the commissioners that simply aren't enough people, enough economists, accountants, lawyers, people who can deal with all of this Russian material. And so, with a very close decision, when we started off into this whole field of competition, a part of the reason was to get a yardstick by which we could measure the performance of a regulated monopoly. And I think that the experiment is in danger of going astray, as you well know, those of you who have read my dissenting opinions in these cases. And I want to make it crystal clear. I'll use the word of a famous man. I want to make it perfectly clear that I am not opposed to competition per se. But the problem that bothers me is that when you read the Carterphone decision and read the reconsideration of the Carterphone decision and read the question that was asked by GTE directly of the FCC at that time, and that question was, does this decision now mean that customers are able to provide their own handsets? And the FCC, as it were, in righteous indignation, raised up their hands and unanimously declared, no, we don't mean that at all. It does not mean that. Nobody can read it to mean that. Then how do we get from Carterphone to Medlin? What decision was made? What probe and search and analytical type conferences were held? What cases came? And I tell you, there were none. We went into interpretation by hindsight of certain decisions that were made. And when the Medlin case came along, I perhaps have been misunderstood on that case. My total position was that since we had an economic inquiry that was designed to elicit the possible effects of competition, even limited competition, on the totality of offerings of the present telecommunication system, that we ought to stop and honestly evaluate where we were going before we got there. Because it's been my experience that once you start down a certain road, it's almost like Humpty Dumpty, that egg breaks. All the king's horses and all the king's men cannot put it together again. And in the specialized common carrier decisions, we talked about new and unique services, and certainly I can appreciate that, and I fully support the commission's decision along that line. But increasingly, we're getting into the same situation that we don't really know what we said, and every time we make a new decision, we have to go back and reread the old decision and decide that while we may not have said it, that's what we must have meant, because otherwise, why did we have this language in there? Now, it's completely impossible for any single commissioner, no matter how brilliant, to be able to deal with 100, 200-page decisions and flyspeck every line, every sentence, every paragraph, every word to get out of it any hidden meanings that might later come to light. And so we are, it seems to be, involved in this competitive stance without having arrived at the first conclusion which should have been made. And there's so many competing and conflicting counterclaims. And I may tell you, and I have no fear of saying this anywhere, that being a member of a minority group and coming from the South and having experienced firsthand the problems of poverty, and they still burn in my mind and my brain. And the last big political fight I had in Memphis was over the fact that we had a mayor who had decided that he would not have a tax increase. And so instead of a tax increase, he imposed a $2 a month garbage collection fee, which seems on the surface, and I know that doesn't disturb anybody here, except if you had been where I was and had at that time pastored hundreds of people whose total tax bill was $28 a year, and the effect of a $2 garbage fee was to almost double that tax in the name of a new thing. But for those who lived on the parkways and the boulevards who were paying $800 and $1,000 a year tax, they only had to pay the same $2 that people who lived at absolute levels of poverty, where $2 a month represents the difference between having meat four times a month and having meat twice a month. That is very difficult in an environment of Washington. And in that environment, it's very difficult to talk about people who live at the very bottom of the level. And there are millions of Americans who do live at the bottom of the economic ladder. And this is why, at the state level of public service commissions, there's such resistance to a rate increase. It doesn't matter if it isn't but a half a cent a month. If you were to have a poll of consumers, they say, no, never, we won't have a rate increase. And of course, logic dictates that at some point that you have to have enough money to do research and development. You have to have enough money to pay the wages that wage increases that come. You have to have enough money to deal with the investment in plant and land. And there is a very close relationship between a commissioner who may be elected by the vote of the people, or even appointed. There's a political sensitivity at the state level that perhaps we don't have to feel at the federal level. But the fact is that I have raised and will continue to raise my voice about competition until I am convinced and satisfied beyond any reasonable shadow of a doubt that competition is that, and not, to use another term, cartelization, that we are simply dividing up the markets. And so we get into a situation that the Civil Aeronautics Board is trying to get out of right now, that you have competition under regulation, which creates an impossible situation, because the minute that I say the rates are too high for business, here comes the competitor and saying, but they're too low, and they are anti-competitive. And so we have to start balancing this. And my first concern, as I try to close, is I think that in this day when government is under suspicion everywhere, where to serve in public service is not a very pleasant prospect, because if I go around to consumer groups, the first question they ask is, why is the FCC in the laps of those they regulate? Why are you so cozy? Why are you so intent on protecting those who are in business? And if I went to a meeting the next day of AT&T, they'd ask, well, why are you so anti-AT&T? Why are you trying to dismember us? If I went to a cable meeting, they would tarnfellow me almost and say, you're doing everything for the broadcast industry. When I go to the broadcast meet the next day, they say, you're giving everything away to cable. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It reminds me of that story of the man who was a little grouchy and his wife was going to make him happy that morning regardless. And so she got up humming and singing and said, what do you want for breakfast? And he thought a minute and said, well, I want grapefruit, also some orange juice. He said, and fix some biscuits from scratch. And then I'd like to have some ham and sausage. And he said, I want two eggs. I want one fried and one scrambled. And the wife went on back, humming and singing, prepared the biscuits, cooked the ham, the sausage, got the grapefruit cut, prepared sugar, orange juice, brought it back to him in bed. And he started drinking the orange juice, eating the grapefruit. And after he finished all of the food, he never even said thank you. Sort of grunted, and she said, honey, how did you like it? I guess he had a little pang because he said, well, the sausage were pretty good. The rest of it was fast. He said, but you made one mistake. You scrambled the wrong egg. And I'm certain that as we move along, no matter, you know, what you try, at the level of government, it looks like we always end up scrambling the wrong egg. But the point that I try to make is that in this beleaguered condition, that if we are to regulate effectively, it seems to me that we have to have the tools and the resources with which to do it. Now, I recognize that doesn't strike a very happy note to talk about giving government more people and more workers. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on government. I'm not an expert on the bureaucracy. I don't know how many people are hired who can't type or who can't answer the phone. I don't know how many people may be just filling time out in these bureaus, but I'm convinced that somebody ought to look at the workload of all of these regulatory agencies in particular and decide, number one, whether or not they ought to exist, and if they ought to exist, then certainly they must have the person power, the budget, the research, and the plans, and the policy to be able to look down. You recognize that we have not really been able to find the difference between data communication and data processing, and depending upon where we draw that line, we put some people in business and take some out. You remember that at one time, Western Union had the rights to the Alexander Graham Bell invention, and they gave it away because they said there'll never come a time when the telephone will supplant the telegraph. And you look at how much money they take in and how much this phone companies, you'd have to wonder what kind of brains they had running. But I look every day, and when I see you here dealing with these new technologies, when I recognize what cable can be in terms of a communication system, when I recognize what the phone company could be, when I think about electronic fund transfers, when I think about electronic newspapers, when I think about the ability to sit in your home and to converse with your elected officials, if indeed you have anything to say to them, when I think about all of the mind-boggling possibilities, and we at the FCC are trying to decide, in effect, what you can and can't do, we may have the effect of deciding that some other folk will be in business and some will not be in business. Where is the public interest? Who represents the public? Who speaks for the folk who cannot speak for themselves? And that doesn't mean that I'm anti-business. I don't mind if the large companies can save some money through specialized common carriers or through new terminal equipment, as long as we are aware of the impact it has upon the totality of the public. And I am convinced that we ought not to move any further at all until we have honestly reassessed this question. That is why I have been the only commissioner in the so-called protection bill that has been filed in Congress by the telephone industry, I suppose, which some 12 senators have co-sponsored, 128 representatives, that I have not, contrary to what has been said, come down in favor of that bill. What I am in favor of is a congressional inquiry, an oversight hearing where we can get the facts. And as Jack Webb used to say in Dragnet, just the facts, lady, not all of the fiction and all of the innuendo and gossip and rumor, not all of the exaggerated figures of loss or gain. Not all the industry are coming out saying, if you do this, I'm dead. If you do this, I'm forever destroyed. But in some way that we can get to the fact, and I continue to believe that in a country with as many brains as we produce and has landed men on the moon, that we can find out the impact, the societal impact. And I'm not just concerned about technology, because technology can run wild. I'm concerned about the men and the women who have to use that technology, who too often have not been spoken for, but have been spoken to. So if this makes me a dunderhead, if this makes me anti-intellectual, if this makes me a tool of the capitalist industry, whatever it may make me, I have to continue to speak my conscience and to say that I think there ought to be a wide-ranging, realistic look, even if it means commissioning some of these great educational institutions to do a comprehensive study. Now, when we handled the prime time rule in television, they had passed the so-called prime time access thing in the FCC before I went to the commission, but we had a reconsideration of it, and we called that prime time two. And we had a three-day public hearing, and we brought people in from everywhere, representing all kinds of organizations, the United Church of Christ, NAACP, Urban League, all kinds of Citizens Communication Center. But when we made that decision, and it went to the Circuit Court of Appeals, they sent it back and said that when you make a decision this important, you ought to involve the public in it. Well, you know, we felt like we'd done it. We've been sitting there 3 days, and that doesn't look like long, but if you have to listen to some of that stuff for 3 days, you'd be glad to hear the truth. But they said, Commissioner Johnson, that we hadn't done enough. But in the whole business of competition and common care, we have never had a public inquiry. We have never invited consumers' union, Ralph Nader groups, the people who take professional interest in these type of things, the various industries, the engineers, the technologists, the people who do these, the economists, the social planners. And there is a role to be played in government, by social planning. We have to be concerned about the societal effects of whatever we do today. We're concerned about environment. We're concerned about the quality of life. And we ought to be concerned about where new technology leads us. And it seems to me that I come down on the side of those who believe that while in the abstract I favor competition, I can never forget in 1919, the Pacific Telephone case, that the concept which the telephone company advocated, that there was more benefit to a telephone in the office of a lawyer, a doctor, candlestick maker, butcher, baker, than in the home of an individual subscriber, therefore, to charge the business person more for the use that they made of the telephone than they did with the residential subscriber was in accordance with the policy of trying to expedite it. You and I know that if you had to charge in South Dakota, the real cost of service to some of those ranches that are back in remote hinterlands as compared with service in some well-built-up city, that would be a difference. And so we've gotten this average price. And there are many, many complications, ramifications, and I confess quite candidly that I'm not sure in the midst of all of these charges and countercharges just where I would stand, but I am sure that we need more information. And when we come to the whole question of competition in the common carrier field, it seems to me that I'm trying to make a plea that the FCC is insufficiently equipped in terms of resources and budget to really assess these things, that we introduce some competition as a yardstick. Our Warren telephone case said that you can't really do that. There has to be more than the possibility of some yardstick before you can grant certain relief to parties who come before you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let me close by saying this, that it's very fitting that we are here in Philadelphia in this bicentennial year where the message of freedom first rung out more than 200 years ago. The symbol of that cracked Liberty Bell ought to be a vivid reminder to all of us today that there's still a great deal of unfinished business in this country. When I look around here, and I said in the outset, when I think in terms of black people who have been historically underrepresented, Hispanic people, and women in this country who have been, and sometimes folks don't like to hear you talk like this, but the fact remains that we've got to acknowledge and recognize that we've made a great mistake in not involving the totality of the American population in all the things that we're trying to do. Because one of the dangers of building a fence is not only do you fence things in, but you fence things out. And the creativity, the talent, and the ability of a lot of people has been artificially kept out of the mainstream of American life. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee. I was raised there until I went to the Army. And I know firsthand the stings and insults, arrows, discrimination, segregation I went to. Practiced law in Memphis back in 1949. I went to a courthouse where I could not use any toilet that didn't have the word colored on it. I know about the colored water fountains. I've been on the back end of the bus in the front end of the train. I had to go to Chicago to law school because there was no room in Tennessee for a discharged black veteran to receive a law education. There is a history of discrimination in this country. There is a history of segregation, and we have to face it honestly and realistically. But in spite of all of the bitter and painful experiences I've had personally, I still have great hope in this country, because as I sit on the FCC, I have to recognize, admit, and realize that only the very few places and the very few times in history have people had the opportunity to make changes that we've made in this country. That it is true. And they talked about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, unalienable rights, that they didn't include certain people, but whether they included us or not, they were written, they were published, they were proclaimed, and folks started believing it. And I've had a chance to travel some, and I've never gone anywhere out of this country other than by round trip ticket, because I have no intention of staying anywhere but here. So I don't join in those who want to destroy the system, who want to tear it up, who want to take it apart, because I think it is a great system primarily because of the opportunity for change which it represents. Because I have seen the change come. Because I went into a courthouse as a judge where everything in there was white except the black folks sitting on the second row. When I left that courthouse, it looked like the keys of a piano board. Black and white together, we were singing, "We shall overcome someday." So I believe that there can be change and positive change. And I think that men and women like you who sit here can make a contribution to it once we recognize that in order to keep the rights you have, it becomes necessary that all citizens of this country feel the same rights. Lyndon Johnson said in the last speech he ever made down in Austin, Texas, a symposium of civil rights leaders, that to be born white in this country was to live on history's mountaintops. To be born black was to live in history's valleys. And I'm glad that Johnson said it because he was a Southern white man who admitted that he was born in a community and an environment where he believed that blacks and Mexicans and others just weren't equal. But somehow in his lifetime, he rid himself of those prejudices and became, in my mind, one of the great presidents that this country has produced, one of the greatest that they have produced. But he was leaving a message on record. A few days after that, he died. And as painful as it is to realize and admit it, we can never go forward until we at least admit that we've made some mistakes and we're going to try to change them. And so for my part, I pledge that I'll be doing my best in Washington to see to it that the promises of the Declaration of Independence, the guarantees of the Constitution, will not only come to black folk, but that white folk will continue to enjoy them. Because contrary to what might have been said about me, I have never said to any white folk, come down. I've just said, move over and give us room to sit with you. And so we come in this year when many of the best and brightest black people in the country are saying they don't even have anything to celebrate this bicentennial year. And I've gone all over this country saying, indeed, we do have something to celebrate because I see the changes that have come and I see the possibilities of changes that are yet to come. And I would ask you to join me in the great crusade to make America one day be what it promises to be but what it never has been yet. So that the words of the hymn that I learned in school many, many years ago will become a blinding, biting reality in our lifetime, in our country. We used to sing, oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains, majesty above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee. And now let us go out, you and I, black and white, rich and poor, men and women, in a day when it's not considered good sense to be patriotic or to talk about God. Let us go out and work to crown that good with brotherhood and sisterhood from sea to shining sea. Thank you.
Mr. Hooks, I think this standing ovation is testimony of both the interest and acceptance and the appreciation of your comments today to this group of engineers and communicators. We certainly appreciate hearing about the FCC from one who serves on the commission and not by reading from it about it from a textbook. We also appreciate your very inspiring comments and your very forthright statements about your position in reference to those problems that are coming before the commission at this time. And at this time, I would like to adjourn this meeting, and we can go on to the sessions that are both here in the Holiday and over at the Marriott. Thank you all.